Pouch of Time. This week's News Front of the World brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine.
The Pacific.
An eyewitness report of the fighting on Okinawa.
San Francisco.
What experienced reporters really expect to happen at the United Nations conference.
Germany.
An on-the-spot report of a visit to the German horror camp.
The home front.
Startling scenes from a new novel which points a cure for the nation's 3 million heavy drinkers. Stand by for this week's News Fronts of the World, brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine on
The March of Time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dwight Wiest, substituting for Westbrook Van Boris, and speaking for the editors of Time magazine. Murder, torture, slaughter, sadism. None of these words seems adequate to describe the deeds currently being revealed in picture and report from the military and civilian prison camps of Germany. Yet every American must grasp the truth of what responsible observers are reporting. On that belief and on our realization of what the Germans are capable of rests one insurance that we shall not soften toward the Germans in the peace years to come. Therefore, tonight, the March of Time brings you the verbatim account of the first interview with Joseph Kramer, SS Commandant of the infamous extermination camp at Belsen, Germany, just captured by British troops. At Belsen, 17,000 men, women, and children were systematically starved to death in 1 month. Dozens are still dying daily, despite medical care by their liberators, because they are too far gone to be saved. Kramer was interviewed by Joseph Weston, reporter for Stars and Stripes, the Army newspaper. Here is how Weston tells the story of an interview that gives a horrifyingly clear portrait of the nature of the enemy.
I interviewed Kramer in a prisoner of war camp near the cell where he's isolated and caged like a wild animal to prevent further attacks on him by enraged Wehrmacht men who are prisoners with him. He's 6 feet tall, weighs 210 pounds, has a brutish square face with close-set pig-like eyes. He's a typical thug. Flesh lumps clot his pasty face from beatings by Belsen inmates and German soldiers since he was captured. He was dressed in cast-off rags after his SS uniform and polished jack boots were taken from him by his former victims. Kramer told me he was born in Munich, 1906. His father was a clerk. When he was 14 years old, he was apprenticed to an electrician. Later, he was unemployed for some years, but in 1933, he became a clerk in a local government office in Augsburg. Joined the Nazi Party that same year. I asked him why.
I had to take a choice between National Socialism and Communism.
What is your religion?
I believe in God. My parents were Catholics, but I parted from the Catholic faith when I joined the Nazi Party. I no longer believe in Catholicism. I follow no religion, because it is impossible to be a good Nazi and a good Catholic at the same time.
Kramer became commandant at the Belsen camp early in 1944. To reach his position, he'd gone through the usual Nazi training for such a job, racial indoctrination and brutalization, and then practical experience as adjutant leader and commandant. Before coming to Belsen, he'd been commandant of a similar camp in Poland for 6 months. I asked him if the German people knew what had been going on in his camp at Belsen.
I have carried out the wishes of the Führer and the German people.
You think you're a good German?
Yes.
You think the people in the camp were inferior to the German people?
I don't think so. They were just as good as German people. There were Germans in the camp, too.
What is your explanation for running the camp the way you did?
It was impossible to do anything better because of difficulties of transportation and general conditions.
What food did you and your family have while you were in charge?
600 grams of meat a week. And anything I wanted. Also, wine and beer.
Why did transportation difficulties not interfere with your rations?
I don't know.
How many people do you think died in your camp?
I do not know. Perhaps thousands. A large number were delivered already dead. from the east. The death rate here was quite small. Only about 1,000 monthly.
The people who died in your camp, have the deaths of these women and children never worried your conscience?
I have no bad conscience. Everything was done in my camp that could be done. Further, I was acting under orders.
Did children die in your camp?
Yes.
You feel any pity for them?
Yes.
You love all children?
Yes.
Yet you let thousands of children die of starvation. Why? Have you ever lain awake at night thinking about the people who died? Including Germans, Jews, communists, British, Russians, Polish, French, Yugoslavs, Dutch, Belgians. The great majority of them, women and kids. What do you think we should do with you?
If one considers the conditions of the camp, then one will excuse me and the other SS men and believe we did all within our power to improve the lot of the people.
You believe there would have been similar camps in Britain and America if Germany had won the war?
They are enemies of the Reich.
In whose hands would you prefer to be? The Americans, the British, or the Russians?
I've never been in the hands of Americans or Russians. But the British have treated me as a man in my position should be treated.
Why did the Germans in the military prisoner of war camp beat you as soon as they saw you? And who were they?
They were former communists.
Joseph Kramer is married and has three small children. And he loves gardening and flowers, especially roses. Such is this whining, lying German butcher. One of many more still to be caught, tried, and punished. Unless we lose our nerve. Time marches on. Yesterday in San Francisco, delegates from 46 United Nations sat down in the most momentous international gathering since Versailles. Although the World Security Conference has already headlined a peace conference, it is not. It is not concerned with boundary lines or reparations. The high purpose is simply to create machinery which will help preserve peace after the peace conference. Perhaps the aims of the U.S. delegation were best expressed by Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg on the floor of the U.S. Senate last week.
Mr. President, I have no illusions that the San Francisco conference can chart the millennium. Please do not expect it of us. But I have faith that we may perfect this charter of peace and justice, so that reasonable men of goodwill shall find in it so much good and so much emancipation for human hopes that all lesser doubts and disagreements may be resolved in its favor.
Tonight, at our March of Time microphone in San Francisco, to report to you on the prospects of the conference is Robert Elson, chief of Time Magazine's Washington Bureau. Come in, San Francisco. Go ahead, Bob Elson.
The San Francisco Conference is all things to all men. Edgar Ansel Maurer, the foreign correspondent, wrote home the other day that this is the greatest gathering since the Last Supper. At press headquarters, Hollywood reporter Hedda Hopper was overheard saying that it was a clambake. Gracie Allen and pundit Walter Lippmann were both in the same press section yesterday when the conference opened. Last Supper or clambake, there never has been a conference like this one. But for the moment, the question of Poland really overshadows everything. When the Soviet Union's Mr. Molotov held a press conference this afternoon, he wound up by saying, "Are there no questions but the Polish question?" The short, stocky little man has cold blue eyes and an engaging smile. He has a direct manner of talking, and he completely stole the show when he met the correspondents. They had been standing for days in the lobby of the St. Francis Hotel, waiting in vain for just one glimpse of Stalin's man. And then the Soviet delegation flashed the word. Mr. Molotov would see the press. The time was set for 2:30. Molotov was 5 minutes late. He swept in like a wind from the steps, threw his soft-brimmed hat to the table. Then he started speaking in a soft Russian voice. His translator, the amazing thin-faced Pavlov, who is Stalin's personal interpreter, breathlessly caught up with him and started putting the words into English. He, like Molotov, talked rapidly and in short, snappy sentences. His voice is slightly touched by an English accent. The assembled correspondents were astounded. Mr. Molotov was apologizing for keeping them waiting. He would, he said, make his government's position on the United Nations conference clear in a speech before the conference itself. He did so at the plenary session held an hour later. Some of you may have heard it. But now, said Mr. Molotov at the press conference, were there any questions? There were. A radio commentator popped up with one about Poland. Could Mr. Molotov explain the position of the Soviet Union on Poland? Molotov countered with a question. Are there any more questions? A roar of laughter greeted him. They thought Molotov was making a wisecrack, but he wasn't. He wanted to know what the other questions were before he answered that one. He quickly corrected himself. He said he would be delighted to answer it. The question of Poland would be resolved on the basis of the excellent decision at Yalta. And then he added, I believe that it is impossible to solve the Polish question without the Poles. His meaning seemed plain enough. The matter still was open for discussion, a hopeful sign. The questions then turned to the Dumbarton Oaks formula. Would the Russians discuss amendments? Molotov opened wide his hands, made a gesture, and said, if there were no amendments, why have a conference? Someone asked why Russia had only asked for 3 instead of 16 votes for her satellite republics. The answer here was short and sweet. We decided to ask for the minimum. Mr. Molotov then added that President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill had acknowledged the justice of giving votes to the White Russian and the Ukraine republics, and the Soviet delegation plainly was prepared to claim them here. To many, Molotov's willingness to talk this afternoon seemed a good omen. Poland seems to be the primary test of the ability of the United Nations to agree. The conference's real purpose is to set up the rules and machinery by which they can work together. And that work is only starting. There will be weeks of talk and discussion about the wording of documents. In the end, a set of rules will emerge, and the United Nations organization start to function. Then, and only then, will come the test of whether the United Nations can really keep the peace.
Thank you, Bob Elson. Time marches on. To most Americans, the names of most of the delegates now in San Francisco sound like names taken at random from a telephone book. And yet any one of these delegates may become a key figure in deciding the shape of the world in which Americans will live. That's why Time magazine gives so much attention in its report this week to helping its readers understand the men and women who are taking part in this historic conference, not only by giving thorough and revealing reports on men like U.S. Delegate Senator Vandenberg and Russian Minister Molotov, but also on other delegates not so well known. For instance,
until just a few months ago, says Time, Philippine Delegate Carlos Garcia was hiding in his native hills, dodging Jap sharpshooters.
Of Egypt's Makram Ebed Pasha, Time reports,
he was a political prisoner in his homeland until just last fall.
And of Britain's delegate, Tiny Ellen Wilkinson, Time recalls,
because of her labors in behalf of homeless, bombed-out Londoners, she is known as the Shelter Queen.
Through human revealing highlights like these and other clear, penetrating reports on the progress of the conference itself, Time helps its readers understand what is happening in San Francisco this week and who is making it happen. Thus, Time reports on all the week's history-making events, from its correspondents on all the important news fronts, from the dispatches of the Associated Press, from many other sources. Time's editors gather the vital facts about the world's news and the world's newsmakers. And then, after careful sifting and weighing, these facts are written into Time as one straight, connected story that helps Time readers understand not only what happened, but why it happened, and what is likely to happen next. That is an important reason why more than 1 million busy, well-informed American families turn each week to the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine. There are in the U.S. some 600,000 confirmed alcoholics, the drunks who can't stop drinking, who are not immoral but sick. There are some 3 million excessive drinkers who are potential alcoholics. To these and their millions of relatives and friends, the Book of the Week, September Remember, shows how alcoholics who want to stop drinking can,
with the help of other alcoholics. It is authored under the name Elliot Tainter by two collaborators, one of whom is an alcoholic himself, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA, as its 17,000 members call it, has 400 chapters in the U.S. and Canada. September Remember tells the story of Avery Rickham, a widower and explorer who returns to New York and his daughter Gail. He is a two-fisted drinker. Without knowing it, he is a sick man. And at a cocktail party, he slaps the daughter he loves to show his contempt for her friends. Then, in remorse, follows a night of drinking, arrest for disorderly conduct, rescue by a former drinking companion, Joe Kelly, and greater remorse. With coffee, Joe finally sobers Avery up.
You're a good friend, Joe.
Sure, I'm a friend of yours, Rick, but that isn't the point.
You mean you'd have done the same for any drunken bum?
Well, I might not have pulled so many wires, but might have gone to bat just the same. Every AA would, we guys in Alcoholics Anonymous.
I don't get it, Joe.
Look, Rick, you serious about laying off the stuff?
Right. Oh, I've tried. God, oh, I've tried cutting down, cutting it out, drinking nothing but beer, never drinking before dinner, never drinking except before dinner. Going on the wagon, falling off the wagon. I stuck it once for 59 days. And usually the 21st day threw me.
Yeah, the wagon isn't any good. Not for a real alky, it isn't.
What difference does it make what you call not taking a drink?
Oh, one whale of a difference. See, Rick, when you're on the wagon, part of your mind's always looking forward to the bender you'll go on at the end of your stretch. The AA, we're only dry for 24 hours at a time. Any dope can lay off liquor for one day, then one more day, and another, and so on.
How can anyone tell whether he's a real alky or not?
Can you walk into a bar and take one drink and walk out? Or does one drink make you feel like there's not enough liquor in the whole world to satisfy you?
Uh-huh.
And how about a shot in the morning? If you need the hair of the dog, you're an alcoholic.
I guess I am, Joe.
Rick attended his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, heard reformed drunkards, men and women who had made the grade, help others by open confession, even joke about their experiences. He went home to Connecticut with Joe. Next morning, in high temper, he stormed into the breakfast room.
Joe, what train are you taking into New York?
Hey, 13.
Good.
Look, Rick, why don't you stay out here a few days? We'll fill you up with fresh air.
I've got to see Gail. I've got to drag her away from those cheap, ridiculous people. That Paul she wants to marry.
No, easy does it, Rick. That's alcoholic talk.
I'm not planning to get drunk, if that's what you mean.
You may not be planning to go on another bender, but any alky who gets in a rage like that is sure heading for one. Besides, it's a lot easier to cut out liquor in the country than it is in New York.
I can't, Joe. I've got to have a different setup.
You tried it once, Rick, and look what happened.
What do you mean?
You ran away after your wife died. You left your kid, shifted your responsibility to your wife's sister.
I left Gail comfortably fixed.
Comfortably fixed. Death took a mother, self-pity got a father. It's my guess that's why you started drinking. You feel guilty about it. You were yellow then. Are you going to be yellow again?
You don't know what you're talking about, Joe. You don't know what I did to Gail when I was drunk Tuesday.
Whatever you did, it couldn't equal what I did. You didn't shoot Gail. I pointed a Colt 45 at a guy I loved like a brother. I forgot the gun was loaded. Then I turned cold sober and took his pulse and found him dead.
You...
accidental shooting, they called it.
You made me feel like a heel, Joe.
Yeah, that was more or less the idea, Rick, so I took the plunge. Believe me, it was a plunge. I've never been able to talk about it to anybody till this minute.
Look, Joe, if that invitation still holds, I'd like to park out here with you for a while.
So Rick stayed on with Joe, learned that an alcoholic has a mental compulsion to drink, a physical allergy to it. For him, drink is a poison. He learned that Alcoholics Anonymous is a strange organization with officers or bylaws. It is a mixture of medicine and religion, and that was one point that bothered him.
Joe, it says you can't stay dry by yourself. You've got to ask help of God.
Now, I'm not irreligious exactly, but I haven't prayed since I was a kid.
You mean you aren't sure about God reaching out and snatching a bottle from your hand?
Never make me believe in miracles.
Isn't it a miracle when a man who's been a down-and-outer, a drunken, good-for-nothing bum sleeping in flop houses and drinking smoke, stand up like a man at an AA meeting?
Well...
Isn't it a miracle when a weak, frightened guy who spent years going from one institution to another can hold up his head and look the world in the face?
Okay, Joe. I'll keep my eyes open for your miracles.
As the result of a telephone call from AA headquarters in New York, Rick soon gets a severe test as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. For members must help other members in distress at any time. In the middle of the night, Rick is sent to call on a man named Pell, whom he does not know. Rick drives several miles to Pell's house. He knocks on the door.
Hello. May I come in?
What? Could this be General Lighthorse Harry Lee arriving with reinforcements?
Could be.
Captain Pell reporting, sir. We attack a door.
Fine.
Yeah. May I offer you a noggin of brandy, General? Mulled wine?
No, nothing, thanks.
Let me make you some coffee, sir. General Washington has done me the honor to praise my coffee.
Coffee would be very good for both of us, Captain. And then we'll ride over to High Pines.
High Pines was a private hospital. Pell strode in, clicked his heels, and saluted Dr. Whale.
General Washington, I presume.
At your service, sir.
General Lee knows this terrain, sir. Now, if you'll excuse me...
You caught on fast, Doctor. I've been Light Horse Harry Lee or Dan'l Boone all night.
Great organization you belong to, Mr. Rickham.
As he drove home, Rick was filled with an immense contentment. He had helped another alcoholic, as he himself had once been helped. Time and again before his first year is up, Rick almost slips. Joe Kelly does slip, and Rick chases him across three states to rescue him. Alcoholics Anonymous are not out to reform the world, just themselves. To the more fortunate people who can drink and are not harmed, they say, more power to you. But it does harm us, and that's what we're interested in. The average alcoholic hates reformers, resents people who preach and scold him. September, remember, is no blue-nosed temperance lecture. Rick's severest test comes when he awaits his turn to speak at meeting. A disabled Marine veteran is concluding.
I'm glad to be here. If I weren't here, I'd be in a flop house in the Bowery. That's where one of your members found me. I guess I'd hit bottom, all right. When I got a discharge on account of my leg, I was pretty sore. But I thought the Merchant Marine would take me. Well, they turned me down, too. Like I said, I was finished. When a hard drinker like me gets a knockdown, I guess he can't help becoming a drunk.
Our next speaker is Mr. Avery Rickham.
I'm an alcoholic. My friend Joe Kelly says I'm an alcoholic with a high bottom. I've never been in an institution, never drunk, smoked, but the bottom I hit was low enough. I haven't felt at ease until tonight, and I'm sure that's because I'm with our group. Something like the old New England town meetings where everyone knew everyone else and could speak his mind. My own hangovers got too bad for ice packs and spirits of ammonia. What scared me most was that my hangovers changed from physical to mental. I had dreadful depressions followed by terrific, unaccountable fear. It was fear of everything. It wasn't fear of dying. It was fear of living. It made me want to die, the way a seasick man wants to die. I've learned a lot from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess I've got a lot to learn, but one of the ideas that helped most of all is the feeling these meetings give you that you're not alone with your problem.
Tonight, the news from Okinawa is good. To Americans whose eyes are held by the somber crash of Germany into defeat, the importance of the Okinawa operation may not be so clear. Yet the men fighting the Pacific War well know all that victory on Okinawa can mean. For a report on the fighting on Okinawa, for an up-to-the-minute outline of its true strategic importance to the U.S., the March of Time now brings you Robert Sherrod, famed war correspondent for Time magazine and author of the bestseller Tarawa. Bob Sherrod has reported Pacific fighting for 39 months. He has gone ashore with the Marines on many a bloody beach. Most recently, he went ashore on Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and he has returned this week to New York to report to his editors and to you. Robert Sherrod.
The latest enemy casualty report issued by Admiral Nimitz shows that only 2 Japanese have surrendered on Okinawa for every 100 killed. The suicide planes that the Japs are now using in such large numbers are new evidence of the Jap fanaticism we are already familiar with. But the suicide plane is probably the most bizarre scheme these strange little men have yet conceived. When they found out they were no match for us in the air, they turned to crashing their planes into our ships in an effort to sink them. In some cases, they've been successful. But our pilots managed to shoot down most of them before they can reach our ships. Of those which do get through, many others are brought down by anti-aircraft gunners. Then, too, our ships are so well built that those which are hit are not likely to sink. We knew when we went to Okinawa that we probably would have to take on the entire Japanese Air Force. That is what we are doing. Not even the insane desperation of pilots who fly their planes into our ships, exploding themselves along with their bombs and planes, has been able to prevent the success of our powerful fleet and our air and ground forces. For Okinawa these days is one of the busiest spots in the Pacific. In the southern 10 miles of the 60-mile Long Island, troops of the 10th Army are fighting a bitter battle against the strongly entrenched Japanese, who you may be sure will fight almost to the last man, no matter how helpless their plight is. But a lot of things also are happening in our 5/6 of the island. Thousands of Army and Marine engineers and Navy Seabees, men who are not accustomed to waiting until the battle is over to go to work, are changing the shape of the island, toiling magnificently and transforming Okinawa into a great base for future operations against Japan. Okinawa will play a big part in the Japanese war from now on. Unquestionably, it is one of the most important steps we have ever taken in the Pacific. It lies only a little more than 300 miles from the main Japanese islands. It should not be long now before American bombers from Okinawa can be hitting the Japs in their homeland. In great numbers, they will share the burden so far borne by planes from the carriers and from B-29s in the Marianas. Besides, if you look at the map, you will see that at Okinawa, we have almost reached the end of the long road across the Pacific, which began at Tarawa and Macon and continued irresistibly through Kwajalein, Eniwetok, Saipan, Tinian, Guam, Peleliu, and Iwo Jima. From Okinawa, there are only 2 places to go, China or Japan. I believe the Pacific War is being shortened by months at Okinawa. That does not mean the Pacific War is nearly over, because at this stage we can only count on all the Japs to fight to the bitter end, regardless of the hopelessness of their sorry cause, regardless of the cost as measured in the lives of human beings.
Time marches on.
Over this same network every afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern Wartime, listen to Time Views the News, another program prepared by the editors and correspondents of Time magazine. The March of Time came to you tonight from San Francisco and New York. And next Thursday evening at this same time, listen again to The March of Time.
This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.